Hi, everyone, and welcome back for another episode of Malice in the Mitten. I am your host, Tracy Preston, along with my bestie, Christine Mulligan. Hey, Christine.
Hey, Tracy. What's going on? Are we ready for another one this week?
Totally ready. This is number 4.
Crazy. It's going pretty fast.
It is going pretty fast. I'm excited. All right. So this is season 1, episode 4, John Eric Armstrong. John Armstrong was born in New Bern, North Carolina. Yes. I know what you're thinking. This is Malice in the Mitten. Why are you talking about a serial killer from North Carolina? True. John was born in North Carolina. However, at the age of 25, after serving 7 years in the Navy, he moved to Michigan. He had himself a boyish face, which they called him Baby Doll.
Okay, let's just start with the fact that he was from North Carolina, New Bern, North Carolina, which we have both been to for work purposes. And that is the cutest little harbor town I really feel like I've ever been in. It's just super cute and quaint and tiny. And maybe because he moved to Michigan, not to, you know, talk about Michigan too bad, because I know that's your hometown state. However, maybe that's where he went wrong. Just saying straight off the bat.
It could have been. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, John was born in New Bern, North Carolina on November 23rd, 1973. John was the oldest of two children. However, when his younger brother was only a few months old, he died from SIDS, which is sudden infant death syndrome, also known as crib death or cot death. As you can imagine, after the loss of his brother, John had a very difficult time coping. He was so devastated that at the age of 5, he tried to kill himself. There were no other details on this, and I'm totally okay with that. My heart just breaks to even think about a little boy trying to die. John's father was abusive toward his mother and also sexually abused John.
Okay, so you totally set the tone that this kid started out on a rough mental track. They said that he tried to kill himself at 5, but they didn't give any other details. And I'm with you. I don't really want to know them either, but that is like one of the interesting things about diving into psychotic minds and listening to what they've done and how they've done it so we can psychoanalyze that. But the fact that there is nothing on that raises a flag for me in the medical industry that we are not doing enough to understand the psyche of children. So when we do have an opportunity to help them, because once these people get to an older age, you know, too little, too late, all of those crazy things. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to dive that deep into it. I'm just saying.
Yeah, you did.
Psychiatry benefactor would have been, I feel, a little bit greater than waiting until it's too far gone.
I absolutely agree with you because, wow, wouldn't that have been the perfect opportunity to help learn and help people? Because the majority of things I feel make a person a psychopath is what happens to them, which we've talked about in all the episodes so far, nature versus nurture. This boy, what happened to him? I'm going with nurture.
Yeah, it's sad. It's a sin. But go ahead. Let's get deeper into what this dude is about.
All right. So it wasn't too long after the death of his brother that his father left the family. Yay. It wasn't until the age of 15. So there you go, Christine. Way too long before this boy got any help. John finally received some therapy to deal with the loss of his brother and secretly the molestation he suffered as well. Despite getting therapy, the deep psychological damage did just that. Damage.
Okay, so right there, you did already give me a lot of information that the father may have been abusive, but he left shortly after the brother died. So that's when he was 5. Is that what you said? At the age of 5, that's when he tried to hurt himself. So how old was he when his brother died?
So I'm going to say maybe 4 to 5 years old.
Okay. So I'm with you on that. Most damage with psychotic people, that all happens when they're young, and that's when we should be attending to it. And that's when we should be hypervigilant and all of that. The father may have been the one that was abusing him. It wasn't until he was 15 that he got mental help, and then he's talking about this abuse. My hairs on the back of my neck are already thinking about what the mother was doing. So I'm just going to lay that out there before we get too deep. Stick a pin in that one.
Pin is stuck. In 1992, at 18 years old, John joined the Navy. He served 7 years on the USS Nimitz aircraft carrier, and this ship is absolutely massive. And some of the documents I was reading, it is said that John was an aircraft refueler. But as I was reading comments from people on the podcast Serial Killers documentaries, there was a man who said he was on the USS Nimitz with John, but he wasn't a friend of John's, but he would be friendly to him. He also said that John wasn't an airplane refueler. He was actually a ship serviceman running the ship's stores and barbershops. He did well in the Navy and was promoted and even earned a couple of good conduct medals while in service. Sailors on the ship with him said that he was a friendly guy, but kept to himself and was pretty quiet. I have to say that I was surprised at how many people commented on the Serial Killers documentary podcast. They were people that were on the USS Nimitz with him, people who had went to school with him, or were teachers of his, and all of them absolutely could not wrap their head around what I'm about to tell you. After John was honorably discharged from the Navy, he moved to Dearborn Heights with his wife and toddler son in 1999. They were living in a small two-story home with his wife's parents. John worked at Target, attended Schoolcraft College, worked as a security guard in Novi, and also worked at the Detroit Metropolitan Airport. On Sunday, January 2nd, 2000, John was driving home from work. He was not feeling well and decided to pull over on a bridge over the Rouge River in Livonia so he could throw up. When he leaned over the bridge, he saw a woman's body in the water. He flagged down some people and asked them if they could call the police. When the police arrived, John was still there. When the police spoke with him, and after hearing his story, they noticed that they had not seen any vomit anywhere or that John was not looking ill at all. When asked by the officers on site to search his vehicle, John gave his consent. Nothing really stood out to the officers, but they did notice an opened Lifestyles condom wrapper on the floor of his vehicle, which they photographed. John was taken to the police station and questioned. He was asked if he likes to pick up prostitutes. He responded that he did not, since he has been with his wife, and he absolutely denied picking up this woman that was found in the Rouge River. Since the police at the time didn't have any evidence against him, he was free to go.
Okay, so the fact that he stayed around, they didn't find vomit. Are we thinking that he's the one that threw over there? Like, that's what they're thinking right now with the fact that he was there, didn't vomit, and they found a condom wrapper? Is that where we're going with this so far? I mean, I'm just asking.
That is where we're going, because to them, he's looking pretty sus.
All right, let's see what happens.
Okay. When this lady was removed from the Rouge River, the rescue team wrapped her hands in plastic in hopes of preserving any evidence that could possibly be present. On Monday, January 3rd, 2000, an autopsy was performed on the woman that was pulled from the river. The cause of death was determined to be manual strangulation. During her autopsy, a rape kit and fingerprinting were performed. The woman in the water was identified through her fingerprints as Wendy Jordan. She was a known prostitute and drug user to the police. Recovered DNA from her body was sent to the lab, but getting the results wouldn't come for months. Per the Twisted Killer show, The Dead Don't Say No, the officers on site noticed that Wendy's leather skirt was pulled down to her ankles. She only had one gold high-heeled shoe on. The officers on site didn't feel that Wendy had floated downstream, as her body was on top of some ice in the river. The police thought one possibility was that Wendy could have been thrown from the bridge. They were already suspicious of John and would keep him on their radar. There was nothing they could do until the DNA results came in. On April 10th, 2000, in southern Detroit, a Conrail freight train's conductor spotted a body not far from the railroad tracks. The body was in plain sight, naked from the waist down, and legs were spread open, revealing the woman's genitalia. Officers observed a pair of tights around the woman's neck and surmised that she was strangled with it, as she had ligature marks on her neck. While officers were combing the area for more clues, they discovered more female bodies, all not far from one another, all in different stages of decomposition. Their bodies were also posed in distastefully sexual positions. The body of these women were identified as Kelly Jean Hood, Robin Brown, and Rose Marie Felt. After this gruesome display of women were discovered, a task force was quickly organized and consisted of the Detroit Police Sex Crimes Unit, the Violent Crimes Task Force, the FBI, the Michigan State Police, the Conrail Railroad Police, and the Wayne County Medical Examiner's Office, all in effort to solve the murders of these women.
Okay, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself again, because, you know,
that's what you do.
I have a habit of doing that. But so he stayed at the scene of the crime. I'm hearing this just as you're telling it to me for the first time as well, just like our listeners. And then I just interject with my incessant annoying questions. But here's the question I got right now. If this was him, so the cops right now, we know that they're keeping him on their radar, but he told somebody to call the cops, waited for the cops to get there, consented to his car being searched, got the picture of the condom and all of that, denied being with prostitutes, even though he had a condom wrapper in his car, and said that he was faithful to his wife. Okay, so those are the facts that we got thus far. What I'm asking is, all of these other women that we're finding about now that have been found in sexually explicit positions, he's not around for. So was that one that he was around for, was that the first one they found?
Yes, I believe that is the first one they found. Yes.
So literally that was just his novice, his psychotic noviceness. This is the novice point of the fact that very well may have been his first one, and he saw how it went down and how they couldn't really figure it out. So he felt confident in doing that. So it literally was an era that taught him not to do that again. And that gives me the creepies.
Yeah, exactly. And like Elias Albulazam, remember the FBI profilers told the police that for every success, there's always the unsuccessful murders. Well, I mean, he was successful at murdering this woman, but where he was unsuccessful is what he did. Now, if he was in New Bern, North Carolina in April and tossed a body over a bridge, they're not going to hit ICE like they're going to hit in Michigan in April. So oopsie, that didn't work.
That's funny. So speaking about failed attempts, that's what's going to tell us. They try to link these all together. I totally get it. Okay. Before I get too far ahead of myself. So go ahead. So they get the task unit all in the effort to solve the murders of these women. And then what happened?
The FBI shared with the Dearborn Heights officers that clearly this killer has been successful at killing. Well, here we go. But for all the times a killer is successful, they also have failed attempts. So again, same information, different police jurisdictions, same concept. With this information, the local police started speaking to prostitutes in the area. They were hoping that one of them may have recently had someone try to harm them, hoping to get some kind of a lead. Their efforts paid off, and they were able to obtain a description of a vehicle, a description of the man driving that vehicle, and they also shared what the man tried to do with them and how they were able to get away. One woman spoke to the police to share what had happened to her. Her name was Wilhelmina Drain. On April 2nd, 2000, she was working as a prostitute on Michigan Avenue near a bus stop waiting to go home. A man in a blue Jeep pulled up and offered to take her home. As crazy as that sounds, she actually took him up on the offer. But as you may have guessed, he took her somewhere else. He parked his Jeep, then tried to strangle her. Luckily, Wilhelmina had mace that she was able to get a hold of, and she sprayed him. She was then able to get out of the vehicle. As the blue Jeep sped away, she threw bottles that were laying around at his Jeep. Wilhelmina provided a description of the man and the vehicle he was driving to the police. Just in case you were wondering, that fit the description of guess who? You guessed it, John Armstrong. But Wilhelmina gave them one identifying description. The man that tried to strangle her had a tattoo of a tiger on his right forearm. With this new information in hand, the police were putting a plan in place to catch John and stop him before he killed another woman. On April 7, 2000, the police learned that John had offered a man named Devin Marcus $40 for a sex act. After the act, John attempted to strangle him as well, but Marcus was able to break free. Both attempted murders of Wilhelmina Drain and Devin Marcus had been reported to the police, along with the description of the man and the vehicle he was driving. On April 11th, 2000, Devin, another prostitute, said a guy picked her up and took her to a place by some railroad tracks. She was being strangled but was able to break free. She also told police that he had a shirt on with a name tag that said Eric. He drove a blue Jeep and had red hair. FBI profilers informed the Dearborn Heights officers that their killer would more than likely return to the same place he always does to pick up prostitutes. Also, their killer gets off sexually from strangulation.
Okay, so I want to know why they weren't looking for that car sooner. They get the Jeep, and they get that in multiple stories. Are they looking for the car?
Yes, and that's coming, because guess what you did?
What?
You got ahead.
I got ahead of myself again?
You did.
All right, I'm sorry. Go ahead. So the FBI FBI profilers, what's their deal? What are they doing now?
Okay, they gave him a little hint that this guy's probably done several, had some unsuccessful attempts. Now he's getting successful. I didn't see really any other profiling that they gave the police.
Other than the fact that he was just getting kind of cocky, doing the same thing over and over again, because it was pretty easy for them to see his pattern quickly.
Exactly, and that he's gonna keep on doing it.
Yeah, which makes sense. That tracks.
Yep. On Wednesday, April 12, 2000, with over 100 officers in place, they were more than ever determined and ready to catch this monster. At midnight, they spotted a blue Jeep. He was driving close to the sidewalk where the prostitutes were congregated. Police quickly swung into action and pulled him over. The driver was asked to step outside of the vehicle. Not only did this guy fit the description given by the prostitutes, on his right arm was a tattoo of a tiger.
I had just mentioned about the Jeep. I'm sorry. I get ahead of myself because you answered that like immediately. So yes, they were on to the Jeep and they got that to nab him. So I will shut up and stop getting ahead of myself.
Well, and also remember that the first girl at the beginning of the story, he threw over the bridge, but he said, I was going to throw up, so I got out. So they had already been suspicious. He was there. They already saw the blue Jeep. They already kind of had him in his sights. It's like, eh, we want to keep an eye on this guy. As police were putting John in the back seat of their cruiser, a prostitute that was standing there walked up to the cruiser and yelled, quote,
"That's the motherfucker that tried to kill me."
At the Dearborn Heights police station, John was in the interrogation room. He sat there with his arms crossed, rocking back and forth as he was questioned about DNA and how it all works. In the Twisted Killers documentary, the officer reached over and touched John's hand with his and said, quote,
"Do you know how DNA works? I just left my DNA on you, and we have a lot of your DNA on these victims."
Once John was told that they had his DNA, he started to confess in great detail. John's MO, which is modus operandi, was as the victims were on top of John having sex with him, he would reach up and strangle them to death. It was during the strangulation of these women that he would be so aroused that he would ejaculate. Once his victim was dead, he would leave their body lying on the ground by the train tracks. So, you know, he could always come back for a visit, have sex with them whenever he wanted because, quote,
he knew they would be there.
John would continue to revisit these women and have sex with them until he couldn't stand the smell of the decomposing body any longer. Yuck.
Okay, so this gets way deeper into psychosis. This guy is not just a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
He is into the dead bodies.
Yeah.
Like, that's a whole nother level. That's interesting.
It's so okay. Deep down there.
Okay. You know, that interests the hell out of me because that's just bananas. Hey, I can't even wrap my head around. Like, I feel like there's no line of discussion that's going to enable me to see that perspective. Like, it's right up there with the pedophilia crap. Like, I just cannot find a path to reach that perspective. And part of all of this that's intriguing to me is looking into their perspective, right? So the murderer's perspective, like, what could have made them do it? What could make them get there? Why are they drawn to this? And yeah, we blame it on abuse. We blame it on bad things happening, trauma, drama, all of that. But for some reason, when we get into sex with dead bodies, there's like a dead end for me on getting their perspective. So let's know. Let's know. What else does he say about that?
Okay. It's so, you're right. Like, how do you even put your brain in that arena of necrophilia? That might be something I'm going to have to do some research on because I mean, murdering in and of itself, I can't put my brain there, but necrophilia and to keep coming back and having sex with these women when they were dead is just, poof, it's out there. All right.
And the only thing that stops you from wanting to be a necrophiliac is the smell? Like, wait, is that the only problem? That's where I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah, it got real stinky. Okay, so, that's the only problem.
So exactly. It's bananas to me. So where do we go from here? So this makes no sense to me at all, but apparently
it's a thing.
It's tracking for some of these detectives, huh?
Yeah. So to the officers, this all made sense because when the bodies were found, they were naked from the waist down and their legs were spread open. Initially, it was thought that the killer left these women in these posed positions for some sick reason, but now they knew why the bodies were that way. And that's because John was having sex with them.
Oh my God. And did he actually think it through that once they started to stiffen up, they needed to stay in those positions? Otherwise he'd be like, he'd have crepitus everywhere while he was doing this. Like crepitus is, you know, when you feel the body's crunching and breaking, the bones are crunching and breaking. That's what crepitus is, right? So do you think that he was aware of crepitus in postmortem?
I don't think so.
Oh my God. That's like a whole, at least that's one pathway I can see. I can see his perspective on posing the bodies like that, at least. Oh my God. Look what's happening to me. We're only four episodes in and I'm already thinking like a murderer.
See, look what I've done. Look what I've done. With John being in custody, coupled with DNA results in hand and a full confession, the police now brought up Wendy Jordan, the lady found on the ice in the Rouge River. John did confess to strangling Wendy, as well as throwing her over the bridge. Since he was new in town, he threw her over the bridge because he really didn't know of any other place that was more out of sight. He made a mistake when he threw her over the bridge. He didn't think about there being ice for her to land on. An uncalculated mistake after all. It's April in Michigan. After this plunder, he was on the prowl for a secret, secluded, personal dumping ground, as he was not about to stop. But John didn't stop confessing here with the Michigan women. He had more to confess. Oh, much, much more. John also confessed to killing women in Washington State, Hong Kong, Hawaii, Thailand, and the Middle East. And these confessions, as well as the ones previously, were very detailed. He confessed to a murder that happened on March 5th, 1988, in Norfolk, Virginia. A 33-year-old Lynette Helag's body was found just 12 miles from the home port of the ship that John worked on in the Navy, the USS Nimitz. Lynette was a prostitute. Just like the others, he would have sex with her, then strangle her to death. Lynette's body was found behind a bingo hall. John said that he left her there. He then ran over her with his vehicle, as if what he did wasn't bad enough. He had to run over her. I believe the number of victims John confessed to was somewhere between 22 and 30 victims. If you think about it, it was easy for him to commit these murders and get away with them. After all, he was a sailor. He comes into port, goes on shore, kills, then gets back to the ship and out to sea.
Bonkers. So he's been doing this all along, and there's people around him all the time, and they think nothing of it. And like you said, he's a sailor. So he comes in, bebop, does what he does, and then bebops right out of town. Like, that's bananas. So he was never, like, really on the radar for most of these murders until he was, for lack of a better term, shitting where he eats, you know, doing it right in his backyard, right at home. And that's when they found him. So he was confident. This guy was confident for a long time. So that kind of explains when I was getting ahead of myself earlier and talking about how did he kill her and, like, wait around for the cops and everything? And that was just his first mistake that led. But that wasn't his first mistake.
Well,
that was just his first mistake doing it close to home.
Doing it in Michigan, because if you remember, he had just moved here. So, you know, his MO before that was easy peasy. He didn't have to really worry. He could just leave him wherever he wanted because he was getting on a ship and taken off, never to return.
Yeah, there was going to be no connection. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no connection to him at all.
Yeah, exactly. And he was in the Navy in the 80s. And we all know DNA really wasn't that great in the 80s. Like, it was just getting, you know, it was just being born, basically. So,
yeah, true story.
Yep.
Yeah. So that also leads me, I don't know if I'm getting ahead of myself again.
Abby.
You may talk about it later, but this might be an off the cuff thing, is that apparently he's always had a fascination with death, which leads back to his brother. Okay. So I get it. I'm getting ahead of myself, because that's why you started all of this off by talking about his dead brother and the fact that he tried to kill himself.
Yep.
Because it's not really murder that he loved, it's death.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a twist I wasn't expecting. So, all right. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So what happened? So they have him in custody and everything. So what happened now?
Yep. So he's confessing. So while he's in police custody, John was also interrogated by the FBI, the Office of U.S. Naval Criminal Investigative Service. That's a big deal. Big time, big deal. The police from Washington State, and even authorities from Far East, in hopes of solving some of the unsolved murders that had happened there with the same MO. But due to lack of good documentation of these murders in other states and countries, they didn't have anything definitive to pin on him. So guess what? He got away with it.
But he confessed to it. I mean, doesn't the confession stand for anything?
They didn't. I don't know. It seems like they don't have anything, like, even though he's confessing to it, they never documented anything very well. So whatever he said, they can't prove it on paper, which
is... Yeah, okay. I get that. any good defense attorney would have gotten them out of the confession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would have.
Yeah, had that a, tracks.
Yeah, they would have had a field day with that. Okay. In March of 2001, John finally went to trial. His attorney, of course, wanted to go to the, quote,
insane defense.
But that didn't pan out. John had been run through the usual battery of tests, and he was found to be sane. Forensics were able to identify fibers of Wendy's clothes in John's Jeep, and a semen was recovered from her body. Luckily for police, Wendy had landed on the ice and not in the water when she was thrown over the bridge. So that was a lifesaver there. After only 2 weeks of trial, John Eric Armstrong was found guilty of first-degree murder of Wendy Jordan and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. John is serving his time in the maximum security prison, Cotton Correctional Facility, near Jackson. While in prison on June 18th, 2001, John was also found guilty and convicted for the murders of the women he left by the railroad tracks: Callie Jean Hood, Robin Brown, Rosemary Felt, and Monica Johnson. The women John murdered did not deserve what happened to them, and I am extremely saddened by how their lives were taken, and most of all, how their bodies were desecrated over and over again in death by the same sick bastard that took their life. And that is the sick, twisted necrophiliac, John Eric Armstrong.
Oh, that was a twist. You got me with the necrophilia. I wasn't really even thinking about that. But that's the crazy thing, is when you were talking about these maniacs, I mean, it's hard to really guesstimate where they're going to take you, because one's crazier than the next.
It is. And see, you gave me a bunch of shit for starting off with children, which I know is difficult and nobody likes to hear about it. But it is important that we talk about these stories. And now I threw necrophilia your way. So careful what you ask for.
All right. So we got it off to a good start. We have 4 episodes on Malice and the Mitten. But I like how they're all not born and raised and demised in the Mitten. I mean, we've branched out a little bit more from the Mitten. So you trying to start something new?
I just need to keep you on your toes. That's all. I mean, we're going to have people that are coming here from other places. And we definitely believe you, me. I've got a lot of stories coming for our listeners that are born and bred here in the Mitten and will do some horrible acts in the Mitten as well.
So, okay, well, you know what? They've all been teaching us that there's tentacles of the psychosis all over the place, because they do tend to move around a little bit when they feel the heat coming on them. So it's not a bad idea to start something and invite our listeners to give us things about their neck of the woods. Maybe we could start making some future connections.
You know what? I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's exactly what we're going to do. So, you know, there's a lot of people here in the great state of Michigan that there's a connection somewhere, a friend, a sister, a brother, a mother, or father. Someone's been touched by some malice that's gone on in the Mitten. So we're going to be looking for stories, and we're going to call it Your Neck of the Woods, where you can write to us. And by the next episode, we're going to give you our email so that you guys can send us your stories from your neck of the woods. And if you want to remain anonymous, you can, or you can give us your first name so we can give you credit for submitting the story. So hang in there, because not only am I going to be bringing you stories, but we're going to bring you stories from the listeners.
That'll be cool. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. There's going to be some pretty amazing stories, because as I talk to people that I'm doing this, I'm like, I get the stories like, oh, I had a girl that I went to college with and she just disappeared. Oh yeah. So I'm going to take it and I'm going to run with it. You can give me as much information as you want. And then I'm going to do the research and see what else I can dig up, and we'll read your stories. Okay, everybody. Well, thank you so much. That is the end of another great episode on Malice in the Mitten. We look forward to seeing you next Malice Monday. Have a great day. See you soon.
Have a good week, guys.